Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Are you bored or unsatisfied with your daily activities? Do you long for a new, exciting experience? If the answer is yes and you're under 21 just like me, then you should consider adding a once-a-week KBOO Youth Collective meeting to your schedule. Side effects will probably include extreme happiness, uncontrollable fits of laughter, a great group of new friends, and yummy snacks. KBOO Youth Collective can cause sudden bouts of inspiration and a yearning to share your words or your inner thoughts with the local community. If joining the collective sounds like a cure for your boredom and lack of an extraordinary after-school activity, then write us at youth@kboo.org or visit us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, or come into one of our Wednesday meetings for a scare-free, risk-free, and always cost-free trial.
Good morning. It's 11 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, the Recovery Zone. Today, Stephanie speaks with folks from People, Places, Things, and they're going to discuss their work in bridging cultural divides. Thanks for tuning into KBOO this morning.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, and this is The Recovery Zone, a show focused on healing our world. My guests today are all part of a cooperative that its founder describes as a business that builds bridges out of language barriers and turning awkward into awesome. And it's working basically to end the disparity in power related to language and culture. Patrick McDade is the founder and program director at People, Places, Things. And he's here in the studio with,
hi Patrick,
with Chrissy Bright, who is coordinator of connection at People, Places, Things, and Jacob Gerke, okay, and who's the coordinator of data. So I guess you're the computer guy, huh?
Something like that, yeah.
Anyway, all three of them are here, and we're going to be talking about their program and also how their program works with and tries to combat things that have to do with social justice, political power, and even their business model, which, as I said just now, is a cooperative, you know, which has a very interesting how do we change our world kind of effect on it. So all of this is about making our world a better place and healing it. But I wanted to start basically with just what you guys got in, how you got involved. And Jacob, let's just start with you. What made you want to be a part of this?
Well, for my entire life, I'd had the goal of leaving the United States and visiting and working in other countries. The first thing that ended up happening was I started volunteering as an ESL teacher in the Lynchwood District about 6 or 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. And just as a matter of chance, while I was doing that, I ran into Patrick here. And I observed the things that he was doing with his program and really enjoyed it. And I've been working with him ever since.
Just sort of hooked up with it, yeah.
Yeah, and it was complete serendipity, yeah.
And what about the program attracted you?
I loved the connection with the community. I loved the way that the teaching isn't focused on the things that academia is focused on necessarily when it comes to language learning. Mm-hmm. We don't focus on explaining things as much. We just focus on kind of...
You mean like parsing sentences?
No diagramming of sentences. There's not a lot of focus on grammar. It's just, you know, give people an example of everyday language and then let them go out and use it, you know?
Great.
So those were some of the things that drew me in at the start.
Cool. And how about you, Chrissy?
Yeah, so I started showing up to classes in like November of 2014 as like a requirement for my senior project to graduate high school. And I was interested in like teaching abroad and like meeting people from other cultures. But like through doing the work, I more like fell in love with like the communities that we were serving. And so like my shift went from like wanting to teach abroad to like seeing how I can serve immigrant and refugee communities here.
Uh-huh, cool. And what made you even get involved in this in the first place? You always have had an interest in language or?
Yeah, I've always had like an interest in, I would say more of like in different cultures and kind of like,
right.
Yeah, like meeting new people.
Right, but it's sort of like now working with refugees and immigrants, it's almost like you're traveling abroad right here in Portland, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that sounds, yeah, it sounds fun. And how about you, Patrick?
Oh, here comes the mic.
Hello. Okay.
I've been teaching English for more than 20 years in community-based settings, meaning sort of non-academic or non-institutional settings like churches and libraries and schools and so forth. And I always did that as a, you know, just kind of something that made me feel good, that felt like I was taking a skill set that I had and opening doors for people. Mm-hmm. But in about 2009, I really felt like I could see some reasons why there was something that needed, I felt like needed to be more coordinated and more awesome, I guess, I don't know, that would really fundamentally bridge gaps between marginalized communities, non-native English speakers, immigrants and refugees, and mainstream systems. So I quit my job at Clackamas County Health Department in 2009 and just set out to try to build a free community-based ESL program that would bring people together.
So, and you just did this like spontaneously, like, or I mean,
well, 15 years spontaneous, you know,
right, as teaching. And basically when you started them, was it just you?
Well, yes. I mean, the short version, actually, this leads right into, you know, the topic of why training is important and really how the whole thing got started. You know, lots of people like to work with immigrants and refugees and to help them. And
you put that in quotes.
Yeah, I put it in quotes just because the term helping can really take on a pejorative connotation rather than a sort of a sense that we're learning together, which is tough to do when, you know, everyone around you speaks English and the person you're working with doesn't. And they're struggling and they want that. So it's complicated, and I'm going to leave some of the nuance out for the moment. But what after doing that for a while, basically at first my classes were, you know, probably not that good. I definitely tried really hard, but people wouldn't come back to them. And after a little while, I made some shifts, and they were things that I thought shouldn't work and wouldn't work, but they did work, and people started coming to those classes, and I got a great deal of satisfaction out of that and felt like I was really having an impact, and decided to it happened critically that one of our other owner circle members, Jake and Chrissy, are members of our owner circle. That'll come up a little bit later. But the first person really to hang out with me was Brooke Stady. She couldn't be here this morning, but Brooke has a master's from PSU. I went to PSU Applied Linguistic Program too. And another member who couldn't be here today, Ramin Tohi, also is getting his bachelor's degree in that same program there. We really value academic experience, but we want to work in the community and figure out how to apply that stuff out there. Anyway, so Brooke came to me. We were doing work at VOS, the Worker Center, in 2008, 2009, and a few other people have really had an influence on me and said, you know, how do I make this class better? And we were working with some Reed College students and inspired by the popular education trainings that VOS was doing at the time and trying to figure out how do we make a popular education ESL program where fellas at the Worker Center come and go and they're all at varying levels and they have other complications in their lives as well. And so that origin story comes from a recognition that people were wanting some guidance about how to facilitate these complex multicultural, multilingual spaces. And so, you know, that's, you know, that kind of, once I saw that the tricks that I was using were working for other people too, I felt like I needed to start training as many people as possible to create a lot of these free ESL spaces where people could connect with each other and access systems.
Right. And your school, I mean, like when I was looking at the website, And you're the data website guy, I guess, Jacoby. But it's sort of like it seemed like there's about 15 or 20 different things that are being offered, and even beyond that, plus the workshops are just, you know, infinite. And it's like, but is the basic emphasis on this is teaching non-native speakers of English to speak English? Or is it both back and forth?
It's a really good question. You know, our goal, or the goal of People, Places, Things, in my view, though that is also shaped by the new folks who come in and how that sort of unfolds. But my goal is to bridge language gaps and to ensure that non-native English speakers have access to all civic spaces. But the trick is that the first thing people think is, well, we need to teach them English. But in my view, we can open a lot more doors if we train native English speakers how to be more welcoming in their communities. So the real trick is that we can't always say this all the time, because people's framework isn't there, is we're going to train you how to teach English using these models, these techniques, and that creates new spaces for immigrants and refugees to come together, but also for community members to meet them. And a lot of people are like, I want to meet the diversity in my community, but I don't want to be insulting, I don't want to be rude, I don't know how to say hi to them, I don't know what they're going to say. Probably people listening can resonate with that feeling.
I can totally resonate.
Yeah. I mean, and so what we're really doing there is, you know, it's messy, but we're kind of, taking people's desire to be helpful and putting them through a training program that teaches them and walks with them and supports them as they learn how to engage with diversity in their communities. One way of kind of hanging your hat on this is to think that, you know, for most immigrants and refugees don't need to be reminded that lots of people are speaking English and maybe they don't understand everything. They don't need to be reminded of that. But if we can train enough people to open more doors and learn how to bridge that gap and sort of build the bridge more than halfway, we can create a lot of access for people just by not being impatient, just by developing relationship, by taking our time, by learning a little bit of the languages and about the people who are in our neighborhoods. So that's the real trick, is that we'll create immigrant integration. That's a term that's used when we train more Anglos or white folks or whichever dominant culture group you kind of want to focus on, how to be more welcoming. And so that brings us into a territory of how do we train people with relative privilege to use their privilege for good? And that really is the key thing that I'm personally concerned about as a spiritual and political goal.
Yeah, I totally want to get to that. And then just to ask, so Chrissy, when you showed up, like, did you feel like, what were the kinds of things, were you learning these kinds of things that Patrick just talked about, like how not to just be clunky when you're dealing with immigrants? Or, I mean, what sort of things that you're going, oh, right, you know?
Yeah, like when I first started facilitating the classes, I was like really nervous because I didn't have a lot of experience working with like people who didn't speak English. Like, that was my main group of people that I hung out with were all like mostly white English speakers.
Right.
So like coming into the classes, it was like a completely new experience for me. So like being nervous, trying to navigate the like trying not to like offend anybody, and also so it was a lot of like trying not to like step over any boundaries.
And you sort of felt like the stuff that you were learning through the Patrick, or the People, Places, Things, we should call it, what we're teaching you how to function that way, basically.
Yeah, like PPT does like kind of like more of like an immersion kind of thing. It's like the only way to get over the awkwardness or like the nervousness is to actually do
just
the thing.
Just do it.
Yeah.
Right. How about you, Jacob?
I guess I was a little bit unique in this regard, in that I wasn't really, my nervousness doesn't keep me from going out and doing new things. I tend to just be more of the loudest, most obnoxious person in any given room. And so the challenge when it came to building my skill set was less getting out and doing the thing rather than just trying to focus my energy in the right way and in the right direction. So I think that was the most valuable thing that I got out of the program.
Yeah, and then what I get is that the classes, I mean, like, the emphasis is on being flexible, on being real. And one of the neatest things about it was that you end up getting people jobs in other countries, jobs in America. I mean, is that a huge part of what you're trying to do with...
It's a huge part of my personal experience. Uh-huh. Like I said before, one of my goals was to go abroad, and I had the fortune of moving to... I lived in China for 3.5 years.
Wow.
And I got that... the reason I got that job was because I went through this program. I earned my TEFL certificate through this program. And the school that I went and taught at for... the first 2.5 years, I mean, most people go there and they've never taught before. And so for me to have, you know, close to 100 hours of classroom experience plus the certificate, all the skills I earned along the way, I mean, that definitely set me out among the crowd of people who are applying for those jobs right now.
Yeah, it's you know, it's just like, especially for young people, like, what an adventure, you know.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah. So we're you're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone, where we focus on healing our world. And the people here with me in the studio right now are co-workers at People, Places, Things, or co-owners, I guess. And it's a business enterprise. It's all about bridging the divide between people who come from different cultures. And that includes Americans who are white and Americans who aren't white. And so we were going to talk then about the role of privilege and power. And I noticed that one of the articles in your website, it was called... White Privilege, Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack by Peggy McIntosh. And one of the quotes that I really related to was that I was taught to see racism only in individual acts of meanness, not in invisible systems that confer dominance on my group. And I kind of related that. And I was wondering if any of you would like to discuss that just a minute.
Like, a lot of my experience, too, before I started working with People, Places, Things was, like, not seeing race or, like, is a really common thing. Or, like, when you see, like, a racist act, it's, more of, like, an individual racism. But, like, through meeting communities and listening to people's stories, like, you'll start to understand more of the, like, institutional and structural racism that exists. So it's moving, like, the oppression of people of color is like, it's more important to focus on, like, the institutional and structural, like, interactions that happen, rather than, like, individual acts of meanness or rudeness. And, like, it's the, like, the things that really are, like, matter are, like, how it's, like, more difficult for somebody, who doesn't speak English to, like, get a job, and, like, their voices are silenced by,
So the structural and the cultural, I mean, that's sort of what I'm trying to understand, and that's, like, what you guys are basically addressing, you know? So like some examples then, like, okay, people who have come to this country recently, they don't speak English, they're having a hard time getting a job. But it's sort of like what I was also getting is that I go around as a white person not even thinking about being white, whereas it seems like in other cultures, you're here and you're just immediately, like, immersed in all this whiteness that you're feeling different. Is that part of what the issue is?
I one thing that I learned when I was in China is what it's like to not be the majority.
Yeah.
I did still experience privilege, specifically talking about employment. It's very easy for a white person to just go to China and find a job. That's not difficult. But you will face difficulties in almost every other aspect of your life. I mean, the language barrier being one thing, cultural barriers being another. And so, for example, going back to the Invisible Knapsack article, that was one thing. We all had to read that when we went through the program. And one of the things that stuck out to me, or two of the things I remember the most, is when you're unpacking this Invisible Knapsack, you're looking at who do I see when I see advertising on TV? Who do I see? Do I see people that look like me?
Right.
In advertising, that's something where me being white growing up in the United States, it was just a guarantee that I could turn on the TV and I could see people that look like me. Whereas if I wasn't white, there's no guarantee that I'm going to see that. And then when I was in China, I was noticing that. I mean, in China, most of the people who are in advertising are Chinese, although there is sort of infatuation with whiteness that's going through advertising in Asia, but for the most part, the people that you're going to see are going to be Asian over there, and then here, most people are going to be white. Another just a little funny thing that I remember from the Invisible Knapsack is the idea that because I'm white and I live here in America, I'm always going to be able to find someone who knows how to cut my hair. Right. And then I also I doubled down on that when I moved to China. It was actually I guess I wouldn't have thought that there would have been a difference between my hair and a Chinese person's hair, but apparently there is. I did find that out while I was over there. So
cool. By the way, I also wanted to mention that we are KBOO and the Recovery Zone, and I'm speaking with Chrissy Bright, who's a coordinator of connection at People, Places, Things, with Jacob Gerke, who's the coordinator of data, and with Patrick McDade, who's actually the founder and program director there. And if you want to call in, the number here at KBOO is 503-821-8387. So just give us a call if you want. Oh, sorry. What is the right number? I've got 231. I did this last time. Okay, 503-231-8187. Okay, sorry about that. 503-231-8187. Just give us a call. And so another thing on the website was, which is sort of what you guys were talking about just now, is that Damali Ayo made a film, We Can Fix This, and that was, you know, that... as whites, we're not constantly being referred to as white or noticing the whiteness of others we're interacting with, but that is an issue if you're not white. And here at KBOO, we've taken this sort of beloved community concept from Martin Luther King, and we've actually been offering anti-oppression workshops, you know, to the staff, board members and stuff, and I think it's been really good. And I was wondering, what kind of things are you doing then at People, Places, Things along these lines?
It's a really tricky question. It's just not easy. Damali Ayo's project. Some people in Portland may remember Damali. She was here, active here for quite a while, and had a huge impact on I think the dialogue here, and continues to have that impact. And I have a great deal of respect for her and her work. I asked if it would be okay if I used some of the I Can Fix It project, which is pretty cool. You can Google it, though. I think I'm not sure what the status of that is. At times she's wanted to, you know, make sure she gets the recognition she's due from that. But you might be able to Google that out there, or find it on our website. And what it does is has five steps that white folks can do and five steps that folks of color can do to address racial injustice. She used to say that America is at a third grade level.
Yeah, I like that.
in terms of racial dialogue.
In terms of like coloring crayons. Yeah.
I think in the last time I heard her speak about it, somewhere on her own website, she said we're maybe at fifth grade now, but still, I don't know. I just, you know, again, I just want to prioritize that it's a great voice. It has a lot, had a lot of impact on me. And I just want to mention another place that's had a lot of impact on me too is Donna Maxey's Race Talks, which happens on the second Tuesday of every month at McMenamin's Kennedy School. And it's always complicated and always awkward and always powerful. And I highly recommend doing that to stay in touch with people here in the community that are engaged with that on a daily basis. There's a lot of other great stuff going on out there too. But how we try to do this, it's almost with every word that I say, I can hear like 500, you know, things that say that's a load of BS. But and in a way, that's true. I mean, the fact that, you know, I'm a white person, I'm a white male. Jake is a white male. Chrissy's a white person. We're all white people in these rooms. Yeah, and you are as well. You know, we're all white folks in this room trying to figure, and we're here saying we're trying to figure it out. And basically, that just means committing to trying not to be dramatic about screwing up a lot. And hopefully you don't screw up so much that you cause more damage than you do good. And you know, one of the sort of watershed questions or dividing questions for me anyway, personally, is the split between, in listening to folks of color and folks who are on the receiving end of oppression, systemic oppression, I hear a lot, hey, we don't want to educate you, go educate yourself. There's plenty of resources out there. At the very least, pay me if you're going to do it, you know? Huh. And I respect that a great deal. And I think that it is true in an important sense. And also, that also means that we will be trying to educate ourselves without the guidance and correction of people who are actually experiencing the oppression, which, Donna has said a number of times, Donna Maxey has said a number of times, that's like, you know, men trying to tell women how to have babies, you know. I think that as white folks or as people of relative privilege, we are actually called upon to be leaders, and that's really problematic, but it doesn't remove the responsibility for us to be leaders in certain spaces. There are many spaces I'm in where it's only white people. And at that point, I may be saying, I have heard the voices of this person, these folks or a person, and this is what they've said, but that's still my interpretation of that. Am I saying it the right way? Am I saying it a way that they would agree with? And that dialogue starts to degrade in those spaces because I don't have the direct experience, the authentic experience of what it's like to be on the receiving end of that particular oppression. So that, you know, I don't know what the final answer of it is, but for me right now, that means, you know, think and reflect, engage, reflect again, keep trying, don't give up. There's another thing that's true is that folks who are on the receiving end of oppressions don't get to walk away from that. Right. And I get to walk away from almost all of them. So I feel like the one thing that I'm not allowed to do if I want to maintain my sense that I'm trying to combat that or help people create liberation collectively together, see myself somewhere in that struggle, that I can't fully be free to engage with other human beings in a liberated way unless they are liberated as well. And it's just complicated there, but walking away is not the can't be an option.
Right.
That's the only thing I know.
And I noticed like a lot of the themes on your website, like you're bringing the pie, like you're welcoming people. And
we're all laughing a little bit.
You're trying anyway. and just that one of the things you really emphasized is that we just have to become better listeners. And I thought that was really good, you know, just, and so even like in the classrooms, you're asking the people, what do they want to learn? You know, you're not telling them, you know, you're asking and you're listening to what they say.
Yeah. Even that's complicated because I mean, I don't speak all the languages of the people who come to the classroom. So what does listening even mean there?
Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, in fact, that was a huge challenge for me. And I would love to hear Jacob and Chrissy talk a little bit about about the pie piece, but just to address a particular thing about listening. I came across a nice article that basically said, you know, the responsibility of people of privilege in those situations is really just to listen. I call it hard listening. Sometimes I think of it as listening even when you're, quote, right. But when you're working across a privilege or power boundary, what you think is right is probably also contextualized in a system that you may be benefiting from. So it's still informational, it's still important, and probably maybe at an emotional level, even more than a technical correctness level, to not be challenging that at that moment. And yet, here we are, you know, three white people on the radio, we get to use our voices, you know.
Right.
So there we go. When I was studying to teach English, me and most of my cohort at PSU, this is around 96, were really inspired by Paulo Freire, and I still am. But a lot of us struggled because one of the key tenets of Freirean literacy pedagogy is, you know, ask people what they need literacy for. But you can't really ask people when there's 11 languages in your classroom what they need that language for. There's an answer to that question. It may be a little bit wider than what we can get into here, but the short version of that, if you hang out with people for long enough, if you watch them, if you listen to them, if you walk with them around, if you try things out in a classroom and you show them stuff and you watch their reactions and you do that thousands of times, you're going to learn a little bit about what people are needing. And our curriculum, which we call the real world curriculum, evolved from started with books and moved towards just bringing in real things from the world and showing them to people and saying, hey, look at this. It's a jar of mustard, you know,
a
bar of soap or whatever, right. You know, or some kid's toy or something like that. And exploring that with language, with dynamic activities that get people connected to each other, because that connection is really what brings people back, not the word that they learned that day, though that definitely makes them feel, yeah, this is worth my time, you know, I'm learning, I learned a word today, but it's the connection and the feeling being seen, I think, that
right.
really draws people back.
And you said
back.
That more and more people were coming back to your classes, and part of it sounds like that just because they were fun and they wanted to be with each other and enjoy that.
Yeah, I want to be careful too, because a lot of ESL teachers, English as a second language teachers, really want to focus on the fun, and fun is important. But if it's too much fun and not enough depth, then a lot of learners will feel like it's not worth their time.
Uh-huh.
The trick is you have to make the real stuff engaging. And I like the word engagement much more.
And fun.
Yeah. Although sometimes it's fun, sometimes it's awkward. But it's never, people are not disengaged, you know. And a lot of that comes from the idea of dinamica, which is a dynamic activities that are used in popular education spaces throughout Latin America, where people are doing something together. Taking dinamicas, also inspired by Theater of the Oppressed, and doing these theater games and then adding language to them and bringing real world content in is kind of like the recipe for our pie, I guess you could say.
Yeah. And there's so many things about this. I mean, like, okay. But anyway, I'm going to do a little, here we are at KBOO again. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, the Recovery Zone. This is a show focused on healing our world. And my guests today want to heal the disconnect that arises when people speak different languages and come from different cultures. And I have here with me Patrick McDade, who founded People, Places, Things, Jacob Gerke, who is their coordinator of data, and Chrissy Bright, who's the coordinator of connection. And one of the things that I also wanted to get into here is that I want to talk about PI and the fact that you guys teach people who speak English how to be with you have Gia cultural something going on there that sounded really interesting to me too, like I could go and just have a Spanish speaker or even some other language, I assume, right? Mm-hmm. Teach me how to speak their language, which, I mean, it's a very back and forth interactive kind of thing going on. But we were going to get into like the fact that politically right now, things have actually sort of gone off the rails as far as I'm concerned in terms of the federal government. And suddenly we have Trump saying that that this Dreamer Act that, let's see, it was the Dreamers, let's see. Anyway, he is like trying to rescind all this. He back in September, people who had been, 800,000 people were supposed to be allowed to stay in America and to work through citizenship. But now that's supposed to be rescinded by March 5th. And And they're even saying it's going to cost the country $43 billion or something. I mean, I'm reading like crazy statistics on this, but this is who we have in the White House now. And I just was wondering, at People, Places, Things, how are you guys seeing what's going on personally? I mean, is this really affecting your students and the people you're interacting with?
I definitely noticed it in the classroom, especially our classes like right after the inauguration last January. Our attendance dropped.
Your attendance dropped.
Yeah, and it's I've noticed like in the classroom, like learners are like, they're more nervous than before, and like there's like the rising number of ICE raids happening around us. So like each of our learners are like more nervous, and like families are being like torn apart by like ICE coming in and like taking family members.
And ICE being, yeah, Jacob.
I was not here at the time of the inauguration, but I know that there was a fear. Just because if you just think about it conceptually, I mean, we've been doing classes the last 2 years, for example, at Midland Library, and we're getting 15, 20, sometimes 25 people a night over there. And if you just think about it conceptually, I mean, that's, upwards of 25 people of, you know, whatever immigration status, just sitting there.
Right.
And
sitting ducks.
literally speaking, they're just sitting there. And so if and the classes are advertised, and so if anyone from ICE just wanted to read that and say, well, hey, they're having an English class over at Midland Library, we know exactly when it's going to happen, we know there's going to be a lot of people there, let's just go there, let's just do it. And so the feeling was unclear, you know, was that kind of thing actually going to happen? And so about this time last year, there was thoughts of canceling classes, there was or just reducing the number of classes. I believe at that time, a lot of our curriculum was actually focused on what to do if ICE comes to your door. I mean,
like real world practical stuff.
I mean, that's what we've been doing. Yeah. That's what we've been doing this whole time. That was one of the big draws of me in this thing, is that it's topical. Mm-hmm. I mean, this year we've been teaching people about OHP. And about
OHP, what's that?
The Oregon Health Plan. We've been teaching people about OHP. We've been teaching people about the American Care Act and how to apply for insurance through that. And then, of course, you know, this time last year, we were teaching people, you know, here's what you say, here's what you do if ICE comes to your door.
Wow.
That was a big thing that was happening.
Wow, that's intense. And because you take people's names and that kind of thing, do you find that they don't want to give you their names?
I've never had a problem getting people's names. I've never found that to be a specific problem. But we at People, Places, Things, we did face another problem after the inauguration, which is that I, as the data coordinator, my main job is to just coordinate a log of everyone who comes to any one of our classes.
Yeah.
Because we're able to do something that I think not a lot of other people in the community are able to do, which is for every site that we run classes at, I run reports saying such and such many people came to our classes this month. And in order to do that, we need their names. We need to be able to know, you know, how many times each person came.
Right.
And another problem that we faced, not just the sitting ducks problem that I mentioned before, but the idea that if you're looking for a specific person, I mean, we track our data through Google. I mean, we use Google Sheets, and that's, I mean, you can make it private, but that's going to be available just about anyone who really wants that data. And so they can say, oh, look, you know, this person was at Rockwood Library at 6 p.m. and they come every single Tuesday. So that, you know, if they're looking for a specific person, they can find that information. And so what we did What People, Places, Things did after the inauguration was we created a little, a very simple algorithm to take real names.
Don't say the algorithm.
I'm not going to say the algorithm. I'm not going to say
the...
It's a very complex algorithm.
I'm not going to say the algorithm. I wasn't going to say it. But it just takes names and
It codes them.
Yes.
Yeah. Good.
That's all we need
so
to say.
So people are coded. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So even if you were to look at our data now, you wouldn't be able to pinpoint
to
a specific
people.
Person. Yeah, right. You wouldn't be able to track person. You would still know... You know, the sitting duck problem is still obviously a problem because you can still see that, you know, we have a lot of people at certain sites, but you wouldn't be able to track a specific person to a specific location now.
And also, just to let listeners know, you can call in. The number here is 503-231-8187. But does it help that, I mean, I think Portland is supposed to be a sanctuary city. Is that defined that, I mean, are there really... a lot of raids and things going on for sure, or is it there's some protection just because we're Portland?
Yeah, I mean, there's no way we can treat this topic well right here, but I want to mention just a couple of things that are important, or at least that I think are important, and some of those are the organizations that are doing the work around this. I mean, VOS Worker Center is doing a lot of work around this. Unite Oregon cares a lot about this issue. Apano cares a lot about this issue. And there's another small new organization, isn't quite a nonprofit yet, called Pueblo Unido that we work with out in East County that's providing support for folks who are undocumented and experiencing the legal system and providing support for them around that. Obviously, the immigration organizations like Lutheran Community Services, Catholic Charities, El Programa Hispano, SOAR, sponsors organized to aid refugees, all those organizations are doing really important work in lots of different kinds of ways. But coming back to your specific question about the sanctuary city issue, we have a lot of classes at the library, like Jacob mentioned, and they are pretty open spaces. And we've been really pleased, and so has the library, about the number of people we've been able to attract to our classes at Rockwood and Midland Library. Hundreds of people come every year making up thousands of visits to our classes. And that is something that I've never really seen in other community-based ESL programs. But I had to ask them at the beginning of the year, like, what protections are there? Because we heard the Board of County Commissioners say that Portland was a sanctuary city.
Yeah.
And then right after that, the story broke that a sheriff's deputy was passing information to ICE in the courthouse.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Immigration ICE. And Customs yeah. Enforcement. The ones who do the deporting.
Right.
And the you know, basically what used to be called La Migra and strikes fear into many families. And definitely a tool that this current administration is using has really turned up the heat on. I mean, there's a lot of fuzzy area about how much authority the president has around that, but definitely this administration has pushed it as far as they could go to create sort of a national deportation force. And there's lots of roundups happened in February of last year. We started seeing that impacting random people around and a couple of folks
here in Portland.
Portland and outlying areas. Mm-hmm. But and it impacted a member of one of our classes. It was unbelievable, actually. She told her story. This was a class in Sandy. And her husband was picked up by ICE on his way to work and had no other charge and spent some time in Tacoma. And I wouldn't normally tell this story at all, except that she chose to go to OPB and tell her entire story. And that link is online. She just tells everything, and it's so courageous of her to do that. But one of the things that she says in that article is that, you know, because because of her experience in the classes at Sandy Library, she felt like somebody cared about her situation and felt seen about that. So even though, you know, maybe it's possible that being there put her in more danger, I don't know.
Right.
I don't really know. But also that was a space that for her that made her feel connected to the community. When I asked the library and the sheriff, who had just been in a meeting with the sheriff, Mike Reese, like 2 weeks before, just about a year ago, and he said, "We do not cooperate with ICE." You know, he said right to me,
wow.
This is a meeting at Augustana Lutheran Church just over a year ago, and literally said to a group of us that we don't cooperate. And then, you know, boom, that happened.
Wow.
So, you know, when I ran into another member of sheriff's office, I said, "Hey, you know, we're not believing it."
Right.
You know, I agree with the reasons you say why we need sanctuary and we need to separate federal from local law enforcement, but you're not, what you're doing is not convincing communities as we're seeing them that it is safe for them to go outside. You want them to report to you when there's crimes because you don't want people hiding information. That's not happening now, you know. You guys need to clarify your policy and we want to see some sanctions on this deputy. It turned out that was not ruled sanction worthy, but they did clarify their policy a little bit, which is helpful, but still doesn't really make us feel necessarily like public spaces are spaces where we want to bring our friends and neighbors
right.
who might be scared of
which
that.
Which is, yeah, it's just living in a world of more and more paranoia. We do have a caller, and Jean, and I want to just mention again, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is the Recovery Zone. I'm interviewing some co-owners here at People, Places, Things, Jacob Gerke, Chrissy Bright, and Patrick McDade. And if you want to call in, the number here is 503-231-8187, KBOO Portland. Jean, what was your question? Jean? Is Jean still...
Maryland, in a place where there was just immigration a lot and everybody was used to it and saw people who were new to our country and saw that they didn't pose a threat. But now I live here in Oregon and there's a lot fewer people, certainly in Central Oregon where I live, and people just pin things on immigrants because they don't know them in person. How do you tackle that?
Hi, does someone want to answer that?
I would say the best way to tackle that is to just put yourself in more contact with immigrants. I mean, I think the best way to overcome differences is just to see how our differences aren't, like the gaps between us culturally aren't quite as wide as people think.
Yeah.
Yeah, going off of like what Jake was just saying, people are afraid of things that they're not familiar with, and there's like a fear of things that are different and like people who are different. So like the only way that we can like help like communities in like more rural areas and like where there's like smaller like immigrant refugee communities is to kind of like normalize that and like get out and get to know these people and like listen to them and like, yeah, like the best way to like eliminate the fear is to get to know the people and like make them your friends.
And thank you. Thanks for that question. What city or town are you speaking about?
Redmond, Oregon.
Redmond, yeah. So, basically that's what I designed this for, is it's a set of practices and programs that actually help bring people into contact with each other. And it works well for people who are, let's say more conservative, just for as a coverall term, who are not necessarily that open or really buy into anti-immigrant rhetoric. But here's the thing, we have to understand if we're, you know, mainstreamers, dominant culture folks, we carry, our footprint is a lot bigger. So it's not just like, "Hi, I want to meet you," you know, that we can step all over people's toes that way. So that's where really what the whole kind of philosophy for PPT is, that white people need training. White people need training, and they need to pay for it, and they need to pay people of color for it, and they can pay us too. So we'd be more than happy to work with the city of Redmond, as we've worked with the city of Portland and other localities, businesses and nonprofits, or organizations that want to do this work, and figure out a way to make it work, and help people learn how to meet members of their community in a more respectful way.
And you offer all kinds of workshops all over the place.
Yeah, we've done that, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, we do have another caller. Who's this? Kara, what would you like to say?
Oh, hi. Your work is wonderful. I'm so for it. One of the things that I've heard from, I'm a progressive, but I live in Salem, from people who are conservatives and progressives and others, conservative. Oh, that, well, because Portland and Salem and a lot of our communities are in an affordable housing crisis right now. There's almost no affordable housing units, and there's such a shortage that families are being pushed out to where they're on the streets. And being sanctuary cities, if a lot of the illegal immigrants were not here, it would open up a whole lot of affordable housing for people who need to be here, who have nowhere else to go. So that was the one downside. And if there were not so many illegal immigrants, we would have more affordable housing units. And that is pretty obvious.
That's a tough thing, especially since there is a crisis in affordable housing for sure.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, first of all, you named yourself as a progressive. Thanks for being a progressive. You just hurt a lot of my friends by saying the word illegal. It's your right to do that. But when you're when you're thinking about that, just think about how you might be using slurs with people. And then some of the generalizations that you're making there, such as if there weren't so many illegals, there would be enough housing for people. When it's really, really clear that there's lots of policies, particularly in the Portland area, that are driving costs up and not allowing, for example, more development inside the urban growth boundary that would reduce the prices on housing. And I just wonder, like, where you're getting those statistics that somehow the number of undocumented folks are causing the housing prices to go up.
I don't think they cause the housing crisis at all. I think, you know, unfair and greed and exploiting the human necessity as if it were a luxury commodity is what is creating the crisis, because they raise the rents to what the market bears. Like,
even and there's no more federal funding for housing.
Even if we were making $15 an hour as a minimum wage, then the landlords would say, oh, well, the market bears it. Let's just raise the rents. And so it's just never ending. We need to cap rent, so that's a whole nother conversation, but that's fact. I mean, I'm just saying, not that I personally believe that, but there's some shred of truth in the fact that if people who were not documented were not here, that may open up a slither or make some more affordable units available that are not currently available.
Yeah, I don't.
Because there are interest prices in every unit. It is really important.
Yeah,
you know, we have to admit there's millions. There's, you know, 100,000. At least.
So just a quick question about the undocumented folks who are using affordable housing. How are they getting their, you know, if they're getting any kind of federal subsidy, where is that coming from? And how would you look at that if their members of their family are documented or are citizens and so have a right to housing? Plus that what you're suggesting is probably, it's pretty sketchy about whether that fits into federal housing law, which, you know, prohibits discrimination based on any number of bases. Plus the fact that it's probably folks who are undocumented and low income who are most likely to be pushed out by raising prices in the first place. We do a lot of work with affordable housing work out in East County. Nobody that's doing this work is suggesting that undocumented folks are somehow taking up too much, you know, federally funded housing. I would really, really challenge you to take some of those strong claims and bring us back some evidence.
We have to get a really good study. So I'm gonna let you go. I know we're running short, but
Okay.
That would be really good.
And then, Jacob, you had a comment, and we do have another caller.
I just had a quick comment. If going back to the original comment from this caller, I think we lost her, but I just wanted to say one thing. I do think everyone who is here has a right to live here, and there's no need versus not need, I think, just to go back to her original comment.
Yeah, and as I said, I think there used to be, especially pre-Reagan, lots of money from the feds for housing, and that's just been decimated over the decades, and now we're down to almost, you know, zilch for
very unfortunate.
Yeah, yeah. Who's our third caller here? Anna, would you like to make your comment or question?
Please hang up now.
Okay, Anna, are you there?
Yes.
Hi. What would you like to say?
Well, I want to put in a good thought that I've spent my entire life making people feel comfortable, because since I was a teenager, I have learned a whole bunch of different languages. And to the point where when I see somebody, if I hear them talking, I'll hesitantly say a greeting in their language, and 95% of the time I'm correct.
Yeah.
That's me teaching myself. The only languages I learned in school were French, basically, and then I picked up Spanish because I was raised in Los Angeles, and then I picked up Arabic later on because I loved the music, and then it went on and on and on, and learned a little bit of Russian, and 5 Asian languages, and a bunch of other stuff too. But the main thing is that I spend my time making people feel comfortable. If I'm helpless to do anything else for them, I do my best to make them feel happy and to let them know that most of the Americans are not happy with their government.
Yes. Jacob, you wanted to say something.
I think it's wonderful that you've taken the initiative to kind of build bridges. It amazes me. I did learn a little bit of Mandarin while I was abroad, and I have had the chance to use that among immigrant communities here in the Portland area, and it is amazing how even just taking the simple step of being able to greet someone in their native language puts them at ease.
Yeah, you just get big smiles all around.
Yeah, you really do. Yeah,
yeah.
2 or 3 words in their language makes them smile and makes them instantly comfortable.
Yeah.
And my little project for myself, because I love to do it, is to make myself always correct my accent until it's good. So whenever I go in a Vietnamese restaurant or talk to my dental hygienist who's Vietnamese, I always greet her in Vietnamese and get a smile out of it. You know, if I go into a Chinese restaurant, I say thank you, xie xie, or doje. Spanish, I'm constantly speaking Spanish. And Arabic, whenever I get a chance, I ask what country you're from, Taki Arabi, and they say, oh, you speak Arabic? And I go, shwaya shwaya, which means little.
Sounds like you need to hook up with people, places, things.
We got some work for you.
Well,
yeah.
You know what? Time to
step it up.
Yeah.
I got a certificate at not PSU, but PCC teach English.
That's great.
As a volunteer. What's that?
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. We just have a couple minutes left, so I want to get going here.
Keep up the good thoughts.
But one quickie, just for 1 minute, could you just describe the fact that you are a cooperative and you're all worker owners? Oh, did you have something, Chrissy?
Never mind.
Okay. Anyway, just really quick, just give a sentence about how the fact is that you're a cooperative and what the philosophy is there.
So we are a cooperative business. Currently, our owner circle consists of 7 people, Patrick, myself, and Chrissy, including 4 other people. We all came into the program, or at least I came into the program just looking to learn how to teach English, and then we needed a data coordinator, and so I ended up stepping into that role, learning those skills and owning part of the business that way.
Uh-huh. And are you like equal owners in all this? How does that go? Chrissy, what do you want to say?
Yeah, so right now, the legal owner of the business is Patrick, but we all like work collectively, like picking up like pieces that need to be done through the program. And, like, the more like we show up and the more work that we're doing, like pushing like the business and support and like serving immigrant and refugee communities, like the more like voice that we get within the organization.
That's cool. And you're basically doing this as kind of a little dig into capitalism, I gather. There is some philosophy behind this, right? To change our world a little bit.
I mean, so the capitalism remark, I suppose, if I wanted to be a true capitalist, I wouldn't do the work here. I would go to Saudi Arabia or China or Asia,
right,
somewhere where I can make a lot more, where I can make a lot more money. So,
right.
But I chose to come back here and do work here, because I think this is where I can do the most good in the shortest amount of time.
Okay, so let's just have your website. What's the People, Places, Things? How do people find you guys?
PPTPDX.com. That's the main website. If you just look up People, Places, Things on Google, I think there's a movie that comes up first, but we'll be on that first page.
I did it when I threw in Portland. People, Places, Things, Portland and Blammo. You guys were first thing.
There it is. Good. There it is.
And you're at the Portland Mercado.
We hang out at the Portland Mercado a lot. We had an office there, but unfortunately we did have to give that up. But generally we can be found there.
Cool. So I just want to thank all of you for coming and sharing your views. It's important stuff. And you've been listening to the co-workers, Patrick McDade, who's the founder of People, Places, Things. He's also their program director. Chrissy Bright, who is the coordinator of Connection, and Jacob Gerke, who is the coordinator of Data. This has been the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. I want to thank Tammy Dean for her fine engineering. Thank you
for
listening.
Tammy. Thanks, Stephanie.
Thank. And stay tuned for Jazz Lives.